This is the smell of a warm 3-day-old egg salad sandwich in a wimpy trash bag.
Wimpy, wimpy, wimpy!
Blech! And this is the smell of that same sandwich in a hefty, ultra-strong trash bag with new Fabuloso lemon scent.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Smell the difference? When life gives you stinky, get hefty, ultra-strong with new Fabuloso lemon scent. It smells like clean, freshly picked lemons. So no matter what's inside your trash, you can stop the stink and smell the lemon.
Hello and welcome to episode 51 of On the Ledge podcast. This intro may sound a little different this morning because I'm coming at you from my potting shed. Oh, hang on, a pigeon's just landed on the roof. Don't eat my brassicas, pigeon. Go on, off you go, pigeon. Go on. It's gone. Episode 51 should be a doozy. I've got an interview with gardening royalty this week. Yes, that's Matthew Biggs, author of many a fine gardening book and regular on BBC Radio 4 Institution Gardener's Question Time. The reason I'm speaking to Matt is that we'll soon be appearing on stage together at Gardener's World Live on Thursday the 14th of June. I do hope you've got your tickets, but if not, listen on and I'll explain more about what you can come and see. I'll also be answering a question about orchid leaves and giving you a mini On the Ledge sew-along update. In fact, let's do the sew-along update now. I wanted to tell you about my coleus, and I'm so proud of these plants. I'll put some pictures up in my show notes, but they're growing so well. They're about a foot tall now, just under a foot tall, and they're just so beautiful, and they've been so easy to grow. I would really recommend you trying some of these coleus if you get the opportunity. I've got one still out here in the potting shed. The rest are, some are in the garden in pots. And I've also put my begonia luxurians that I was talking to Alice Fowler about outside. And you know what? It's suddenly starting to perk up and look amazing. So there you go. That's all it needed was to go outside. So my coleus have done really well this year. It's a beautiful foliage plant. Super easy and super cheap to grow from seed. I would highly recommend you giving this a try. And in fact, it's probably not too late to sow some seed now if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. You can get on and do it, and you can have plants that will last right through to the first frost if they're outside. If you bring them inside, you can take cuttings. I can't remember if I've mentioned this in the past, but there is also a technique I heard about where somebody literally just took cuttings of their coleus in the autumn and used water propagation, kept them in that jar of water all winter time long, and then potted them up in the spring. So I'm going to try and keep the best of my coleus alive through the winter. I've basically treated them a bit like tomato plants. I've potted them on regularly and I've fed them vigorously, and that seems to have done the trick. So I'm really happy about that. On the half-dead houseplants front, I'm just moving forward to have a look at these. I posted a picture ages ago of my Drosera and showed how miserable it was looking, but it's come outside to the potting shed and it's getting a lot more sun out here now, and it's absolutely doing beautifully. In fact, I've divided it. I've taken out two plants from the big clump, and they're doing so well now. And we had fun last week. I brought one into the kitchen to catch some flies that were in the kitchen, and it duly did so, and we had great fun watching the leaves curl around its prey, and that was great fun for my son. So this is why carnivorous plants are great if you've got children. They are massively entertaining. My carnivorous plants, I've got a sundew and I've got a selection of Venus flytraps, are doing really well at the minute. I can feel that my carnivorous plant obsession is beginning to burgeon, so there might be some more adding to the collection soon. My pinguicula has been really unhappy. I let it get sunburnt, silly person that I am, but it's recovering really well, so that's good. And moving any plant, as we've said before, outside into very bright light after being inside for the winter is a silly mistake. I've learnt my lesson now, and I've been putting things under fleece in the shed if they've been coming outside, then gradually moving that off as time goes by, which allows them to adapt. So that's a little update from my potting shed. But now it's time to talk to Matthew Biggs, and we cover everything from his favourite houseplants to working with the legendary Roy Lancaster to what we're going to be getting up to at Gardeners World Live. I hope you enjoy the interview, and I'll see you halfway through for a Q&A.
Yeah, hello, my name's Matthew Biggs. I'm a gardening writer and broadcaster, and I love it.
It's so nice to meet a fellow enthusiast. I'm looking out onto my garden. Chelsea, it ain't, but it's a wonderful hobby. And I have to say, Matthew, that some of your books were early inspirations for me in terms of
That's terribly kind.
Well, I've got your complete book of vegetables. I was looking on my bookshelf to see which ones I've got. Some of those classic books which really inspired me to think about vegetables in a wider sense than the usual suspects, and got me into thinking about more unusual vegetables and trying new things at a time when probably that was quite cutting edge. But I also noted, I also did a bit more research, and I didn't realise that you'd written a book with Roy Lancaster about houseplants called What Houseplant Where. I've just ordered it now to get a secondhand copy, because I'm really keen to see this book.
May I be rude and ask how much you paid for it? Because I suspect not a lot these days.
Oh, I don't know. It wasn't very much, but I'm really looking forward to reading it, because there aren't many good houseplant books out there. And this is by you and Roy Lancaster, who is another hero of mine. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that book when I get it. You've written a lot of books over the years, but that one, how did that one come about?
Well, it came about, Roy and I had travelled quite a lot. We led gardening cruises. I mean, Roy's obviously travelled further afield, but we ended up going to the Caribbean and visiting the tropics. And Roy had written a series of What Plant Wears, and he'd done perennials and trees and shrubs, and he was asked to do houseplants, and he very kindly asked whether I would like to do that too. And it's quite funny, I suppose, in a way, because there's lots of excitement about houseplants at the moment, which is absolutely great. But Roy and I, and several of my colleagues these days, we're of a vintage where we remember almost like, well, it wouldn't have been the first time, but another time round when houseplants came to the fore. And it's fascinating how things are cyclical. And I'm absolutely delighted that people are rediscovering them again, because it makes a world of difference to your living environment. And also it makes people realise that you don't have to have a garden to garden. And I think that's really important, because if you tend your house plants, you know, you get all of the benefits that go with it. So Roy was asked to write this tropical plant book. So we sort of got our heads together and came up with something, you know, a book for a typical Dorling Kindersley book, sort of picture led, concise information, and still beautifully laid out. In fact, I did wonder whether we should ask them whether needed to revise and reissue it.
Definitely. I think it would do really well. And it is that What Plant Where idea is so key, isn't it? And it applies to houseplants just as much as to garden plants, in that if you're growing houseplants and you're bringing them into your house, if you've got just half an idea of where they need to go, then you're going to have a greater chance of success than just plonking them on the nearest shelf, whatever they may be.
Well, there's two people who are really great too, who I've met at growing houseplants. Of course, one's Anne Spinningbank, who's, you know, is a great houseplant and conservatory plant grower. And even though she's a superb all-round gardener, she sort of rather made her name many years ago for her knowledge of houseplants. And she travelled around the Caribbean with Channel 4 many years ago and did a garden plant series. But of course, most of those plants would translate into the house. And the other great house plant grower I also met was a girl, and she's married now, but her name was Lisa Williams, and she was a nurse who I used to know. And she was in the nurse's home at St. Mary's in Paddington, and all her house plants were fantastic. And I think it was something to do with the temperatures there, because the temperatures always seem to be cranked up in the nurse's home. I suppose they were sort of used to their sort of temperate ward temperatures, and so consequently there the nurse's home was at the same temperature, and of course she was used to tending and caring, and they became her pets. and, you know, as it were. And so she looked after them. And it was that nurturing instinct that she ended up doing brilliantly at her job. And it was because she cared, and she cared for her houseplants, and she cared for the people she worked with. So they're both of them were extremely good and accomplished houseplant growers. But the houseplants are great because they are actually so, you know, so forgiving. But I do think it's important if you know where they come from. It's like the garden plants. If you know where they come from, then that really helps to position them in the house.
Now, people may recognise your voice, your dulcet tones from Gardener's Question Time, where you are a fixture on the wonderful institution of BBC Radio 4 that is Gardener's Question Time. What's it like doing that show? And do you get many questions about houseplants?
The first one, what, you know, what's it like? One thing is, it's a massive honour. Every time I sit in one of the chairs, I feel it's a massive honour. And I mean, it's difficult to speak for other people, but I don't think that any of us sort of take it for granted. You do realise that it's part of a wonderful heritage with great plants, people and characters that have sat in those chairs and answered questions. So I think you do, I feel most certainly, it's not a heavy burden of history, but you're aware of the history of it. What's it like? I think a lot of more people, when they come to a recording, they're quite aware of how funny it is. You know, they go, oh, that's a surprise. You know, it's a real surprise how funny it is and how we get on as pals, and it's gardeners having a chat and having an opinion. So even if there are, you know, disagreements, which people, you know, like, because it's, you know, like a bit to be contentious, it's never nasty. It's always, well, I've discovered this and I've discovered that, and there's plenty of leg pulling. So yeah, lots of fun, but also nerve-wracking, because you don't know the questions beforehand. And I think that's something that people don't realize. We're not told the questions beforehand. They're selected by Peter or Eric, whoever is the chairman of the day. They're selected on the spot. They're brought in by the ladies and gentlemen and the children who come to visit. Any member of the audience can pop in a question, they do so. And the first time we hear them is when they're read out.
Well, I have to say, one of my long-term bucket list is asking a question on Gardener's Question Time. I've achieved one of my other Radio 4 related bucket list items in that I was recently interviewed on You and Yours. That was another one in the bag. And years
great.
Ago, I was on Woman's Hour talking about, not about plants, but about when I was a real journalist, talking about an email scam, funnily enough. So yeah, I that's my next sort of Radio 4 related bucket list, is to get to a recording and ask a question.
I'm sure you will one day, because the other lovely thing about Gardener's Question Time is that it's all, you know, around the British Isles and sometimes beyond. So the chances of them ending up somewhere near where you live is extremely high.
Well, I do know that one of the local allotment associations is putting in a request right now. So that that should hopefully result in a visit before long, which would be wonderful. And, you know, I mean, I think that is, you're right, that is what makes it so fun, is the fact that you don't know the questions. And also, you know, I mean, there's so many great personalities on that panel. I mean, I love hearing Anne talk about houseplants, because obviously that's my personal passion. But, you know, you've got James Alexander Sinclair. I don't know where that popped out from. James Wong. You know, you've got Bob, obviously Bob Flowerdew, who was in fact on my very first episode of On the Ledge, talking about the Swiss cheese plant and its fruit. So it's a real delight to hear those different voices and different opinions coming together. Welcome back to the Potting Shed. It's now time for Question of the Week. And this week, Mary Beaton emailed with a question about her Phalaenopsis orchid, and she's a bit worried. She thinks that it might have some kind of fungus or problem because the edges of the leaves are turning a little bit red. She sent me some photos. I'll include one of those in the show notes so you can have a look. She said she can't see any sign of any pests, but she's still worried that there might be a problem with her orchid. So I took a close look at the photos, and yes, the edges of the leaves on the top and bottom surface do seem to be rather reddish. And usually this is a sign that the plant is getting a little bit too much light. So Phalaenopsis generally like to be on a north or east facing window situation. This gives them the right amount of light. They don't like to be in blaring sunlight. And if you have them on a windowsill in either of those settings, then they will get just about the right amount of light. West-facing windowsills are okay, provided that they're maybe a little bit away from the actual window, or they get a little bit of shade in the afternoon. South-facing windowsills are really a no-no, it's just too bright. So I think that this redness is a response to too much light. Plants often do this when they are a little bit sunburnt, they turn red. The other reaction that some plants have, including orchids, is that the leaves can turn very pale and yellow. So if you're seeing either of these symptoms in your orchid, then do consider whether it's in the right spot for light. But I don't think there's too much to worry about here, Mary. Phalaenopsis are incredibly tough, they really are, and I don't think that this one is going to suffer too badly if you can just adjust the lighting position just a little bit and move it somewhere slightly more shaded. Then I think your orchid will come back very strongly. I'm going to be doing a Phalaenopsis special in an upcoming episode because I'm going to visit Double H Orchids on the south coast of England and find out all of their orchid tips and information. So listen out for that Phalaenopsis episode coming soon. And if you've got a question for On The Ledge, it's easy. Just drop me an email to ontheledgepodcast@gmail.com and I will endeavour to help you. But now, back to Matt Biggs. We're going to be appearing on stage together, aren't we, at Gardeners World Live this next month. In fact, it's coming up quickly now. I guess I should write my talk. I have done some work on it. This is exciting, though, because there's going to be a whole stage devoted to interior planting and floristry. Tell me a bit more about what you've got going on that stage other than me, which is just one small part of it on one day.
Yeah, well, we have Jonathan Mosley coming along, and he's a great value for money. He's a wonderful florist. And the other great thing about him is that he's actually a gardener, too. So when you talk to him, you're talking to a gardener florist, and he's a wonderful character, totally charming, lots of fun and really good at his job and always full of ideas. And I've had the pleasure and the privilege of working with him several times over the years. And you see, it's such a joy to work with. He's got a lovely voice to listen to. So anybody who sits and listens to him he's very sort of easy on the ear, very entertaining, but also very informative. And he has this wonderful talent like hairdressers do of being able to chat to you about all sorts of things while he works, and so he can sort of split his mind into controlling his hands to make the, to put the bouquets together or the displays together. He can, have the other part of his mind chatting to you, and the other one almost thinking about what he's going to do next. So it's an immense talent, but lightly carried, and he's just very entertaining. I'm going to do a few little chats about, how to keep your house plants healthy. So I've got, we'll try and get some props on there so we can look at healthy. I won't be bringing any poorly house plants in, but it just is quite nice to have those to show. So we'll be chatting about those. And we have Mr. Plant Geek coming on, Michael Perry. And Michael's he's a houseplant man. He's very experienced in that area. So he's going to be chatting at the sort of weird and wacky side of houseplants too. So we've got a lot of variety. And I'm hoping also that we're going to perhaps during the, get a little bit of time for questions and answers. And we can answer the public's questions because people go to a flower show actually wanting their questions answered, funnily enough. They come there, yes, to have a great day out and to buy some plants and to add to their own collections. But they're always looking, you know, is there somebody who could answer this problem I've got? Is there somebody who could help me here? And so I'm hoping to be able to sneak in some Q&As a bit as well. But I think the most important thing is that we show that it's fun. And people, you know, there is an element of experimentation. There always is with gardening. I think if you're a new gardener, you buy something, then you know, hopefully have got a location for it. It's very helpful to have done a bit of revision about the kind of plants that you're going to put in your house anyway, just to check that you've got the location. Also to say, look, I've got a steamy bathroom or a sunny window or a slightly drafty lounge or a shady corner. And then to do some research beforehand and then to work out which plants suit, make your choice, and then see how they grow. But the actual growing of them is trial and error. And I think people should remember that, and they shouldn't be hard on themselves. And, you know, it's not a really heavy scene if your plant dies. You go, well, why has it died? You know, what have I done? Have I drowned it? Has it died through lack of moisture? Is it died because it's not getting enough light? Is it faded away because of that? So it's all experimentation. And so long as you learn from your experiences, that's what eventually makes you, you know, a good gardener. And that's why a lot of the great gardeners either have an instinct for it or, you know, 500 years old.
And Matthew, tell us what houseplants particularly fascinate you in terms of your own growing and collection. Is there a particular group, or do you like to kind of mix it up and just whatever takes your fancy? Or is there a particular group that really you dedicate yourself to?
Well, one of the joys of horticulture and of growing plants, wherever you're growing them, is the variety. It's such a broad church, you know, you go from bulbs to, you know, to giant trees and you know, annuals to perennials, and then you can go in different climates from alpine to humid tropics. So it's this great diversity within a garden, and I think within the house as well, because all those, or a lot of those climates are there. But I've been privileged, as I mentioned early on, to go to the tropics. And I love the colour. I love the architecture of the plants, the lushness of the growth. I love the warmth and the sunshine and all those things that we don't get with any great consistency in Britain and other parts of Europe. So I just buy plants almost that take my fancy, as it were, and grow them that way. So I do like the architectural, but you know, you still can't beat a really well-grown Monstera deliciosa, the cheese plant, or, you know, the fantastic Epipremnum aureum, the devil's ivy, which, you know, will grow in the darkest of dark places. And there are some really beautiful aspidistras, for example, that are great for very sort of dull, you know, very dark corners. That's hence the Victorians liking them. And I think if anybody is wanting to buy house plants, you know, if you can find a good local supplier, and there are specialist cacti shops, and I'm very fortunate that my local garden centre has a stunning display of house plants, and they have done for years, interestingly. You know, you go in there and it's full of primarily these days windowsill orchids and lots of good old Streptocarpus, but the interesting cacti, and succulents too. So I think the ability to be able to choose and to buy and to experiment is, you know, is part of the fun, part of the deal. Also worth looking out for if you're buying, you mentioned Chelsea, Jane, Krug Farm Plants has a really interesting collection of aspidistras. Really interesting.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Matthew, because by the time people are listening to this, they will have heard in last Friday's episode my interview with Robbie Blackhall Miles, who was until a few months ago worked at Krug Farm. My interview with Robbie about the aspidistras on that very stand.
Well, so there you go.
You are.
Two plugs in.
You've
two
read
weeks.
My mind. You've yeah. read my mind.
There was another great plant collector called Mikinori Ogisu. In fact, there is, because he's still around and he's still collecting. So Mikinori Ogisu, the great plant collector, he several years ago collected a lot of very interesting aspidistras. And of course, the aspidistra is great because you've got, you know, the architectural foliage, but there's all sorts of sort of blotches and stripes and mottling and different shaped leaves and forms. So, you know, that's really sort of opened everything up. And of course, if you live in a city or have a sheltered garden, the aspidistra can also go outside and be planted somewhere shady under a shrub and can be an outdoor plant too, hence Krug Farm selling them. So it is also quite interesting to put your house plants in the summer, put them outdoors in the summer and bring them in during the winter, or as the, obviously they've got to come in before the first frost. So as the temperatures start to drop, you move them in. And I don't think you can ever move them in too early, but it's very easy to move them in when it's too late. So they don't like their frost, but they do. One year I made some, well, I thought they were quite successful displays, you know, grouping house plants together. And of course, in the house, they make more impact grouped together and they grow better grouped together because of the increased humidity for most of the tropical and temperate plants. So I think if you can make, you know, if you can think of the versatility of house plants, you get a really good deal out of them.
You certainly do. They certainly last a lot longer than the average bunch of flowers. You get some several months, even if they do die, then you've had months of enjoyment out of them, which is not a bad deal.
What I think is really important for people to remember is that flowers in the house, whether they're cut flowers, and there is a campaign to buy, and you'll hear this from Jonathan Mosley if you go to Gardeners World Live, but there is a campaign to support British growers, and that was very evident at Chelsea as well. And there are a lot of British growers of cut flowers, of bulbs. There was a lovely display at Chelsea called Flowers from the Farm. And I think, if I remember right, it's around 500 small growers, people growing cut flowers on allotments, in small farms, small holdings, to supply cut flowers for the house, for bouquets, for posies. And I just think, if you know, there's always a chance to bring flower into your house. And I think that's really important. We should support our own industry. And just a little vase of flowers. If you've got lots of architectural house plants, the architecture is there, but it's also nice to bring the colour in too. So I do feel that growing plants inside your house should encompass cut flowers as well as house plants.
I totally agree. I'm always bringing stuff in from the garden and trying to support local flower growers because, as you say, it just adds a certain something, doesn't it? But I'm also a champion of the flowering houseplants as well, which I still think is, I don't know if you agree with me on this, but I still think there is room for a revolution with our flowering houseplants because, and that this could be the next big thing. We're all into the big bold foliage, but actually there's so many amazing flowering houseplants too.
Yeah, absolutely. There are, and you know, we mentioned the Streptocarpus, and you know, they are stunning and flower over a long period. There's a fabulous range of flowers within those. You can go for things, you know, even like you can double bubble with the Aphalandra squarosa. That's always good. Great for a warm, humid spot and produces nice, bright yellow flowers, or you know, something like Euphorbia milii, very, very spiky, very, very spiny, so needs to be sort of kept out, you know, out of the way of passing traffic, but still great for perhaps a spot in the corner of a conservatory or in a corner of the room with those fabulous bracts that range from, so I've seen them in mustard yellow right through to sort of bright pink. And then you've got the traditional things like, you know, cacti. People often forget that cacti flower. They need a cool, dry winter rest, and they need to obviously reach a stage of maturity too, and feeding with high potash fertilizer during the growing period, and that encourages the flowering. And cacti in flower are absolutely astonishing for the range of really vivid, absolutely gorgeous colors, from sort of reds and cerises to, you know, bright pinks and oranges. All the flower colors are, they're really funky, and if you get them flowering, you know, that's great too. Gloxinias, a wonderful old traditional house plant. My dad always used to buy one of those in the spring for my mother, and of course they have gorgeous flowers, you know, the deep, rich colour, really rich, vibrant reds and blues, very regal plants. So there's lots of small house plants, don't take up a lot of space, doesn't need to be, you know, something sort of massive leaf, doesn't need, you know, take up the space of a palm, but can just be sat on a tiny windowsill and flower, and even little tiny plants like, you know, lithops. I've had my lithops in flower recently. You know, they're a little fun plant for children. I used to have a tray. Well, I still have, actually. I've got a tray of lithops in the toilet, but nobody gets the schoolboy joke. So it's sort of hardly worth having, but it made me chuckle when I did it, because of course they all look like bottoms. They will flower too. So I think you've got, you know, lots of variety, and of course you've got, you know, the phalaenopsis and the, you know, the cymbidiums, the wonderful orchids. And I think it's a shame in a way that we draw, you know, the windowsill orchid has sort of taken over. Of course it has. It's fantastic. You know, they're wonderful plants. But they flower for months and months. You know, as you know, Jane, once you finish, they finish flowering, you don't cut the flowering spike off, but you just work your way down, taking full advantage of the bud below, which will then sprout and produce another set of flowers. So I think there's lots and lots of interest. And of course, if you make yourself a terrarium as well, that creates a change of habitat and becomes, you know, a source of fun. And I know that you can get the old bottled terrarium still, but one of the easiest and most straightforward ways to make a nice little landscape is to use an old rectangular fish tank, or even a new one, and pop that in, and I think you see your plants very well there. And if you really get into it, of course, you can make yourself a terrarium out of a windowsill, and have glass panels in front of it, and really, you know, really go to town. But I just think there's so many options for, you know, look at the space that you've got, check what the climate's that like there, do a bit of research on the kind of plant, and get, you know, one plant, two plants, perhaps fit, you know, three or four plants together, because I think a display, you know, is always more impactful than just having single plants together.
Yeah, I agree. And just on the gloxinias, I always think they're sort of the Dame Barbara Cartland of the houseplant world. They're just so ridiculously over the top and deliciously so. I think that's another, as you say, that's another one that used to be really quite popular, but isn't so much around these days. I think we need to definitely bring back the gloxinia. I'm sure that's a bridge too far for some people. But I remember when people were saying the same thing about dahlias. Oh, we're never going to grow dahlias again because they're too OTT. And now, obviously, everyone's growing dahlias. I also love Euphorbia millii. That's one of the plants that I had as a teenager that I really enjoyed having. I don't know what happened to that plant. I don't have one anymore. I think I probably steered clear of it because of imagining my children encountering the spikes and just not being able to resist giving it a good poke and then paying for it.
They would only do it once, don't they? I mean, I think it's like,
well, true.
People, you know, you should put them out of the way. Obviously, you don't want to risk anyone. But it's curious fingers, and I think it's a little bit like it's how people learn about danger and safety, I think, in a way. So as long as they don't hurt themselves too much, you'd only have to rest your finger on it slightly. I think we've all done it and we've all survived. But I just think it's, you know, you have to take care, but you can't cushion people, sadly, from all prickles.
Agreed.
In life. And if once they get out to be in the garden, they'll find roses have got prickles and, you know, pyracanthus, and they will have learned already just even a light little finger on a spine is enough to hurt. So watch out and, you know, avoid them at all costs, which is, of course, what the plant wants you to do.
Exactly. I wrote a piece for The Guardian about Chelsea and recommending some of the euphorbias that were growing. And somebody in the comments criticised me for recommending euphorbias because the sap burns the skin.
Well, funnily enough, I read that this morning, and I read the comments, and the comments were really interesting. And I have to say, you know, there, a lot of the comments were obviously by people who aren't gardeners and who don't understand it. And and just want to voice an opinion.
Exactly, and that's the funny thing about writing for The Guardian is obviously there's it's on the front page of the website. Some people are clicking through and they're not really interested in gardening. They just want to make a controversial comment. And it's absolutely fine. And just like Gardener's Question Time, the great thing is I love having a great discussion with another gardener about something and disagreeing over something because that's part of the fun. But you just don't take it too personally. But it did make me laugh because I thought, gosh, if you don't want to have euphorbias, whether they be houseplants or in the garden because of the sap being toxic, then you'd be very, very limited in terms of houseplants and garden plants if you avoided anything that was toxic. Because, gosh, aren't there so many things that could harm you?
I think there are some when it comes to poisonous plants. There are some like the euphorbias and, you should be aware of it. There were several instances in the comments there where people had suffered, and I've had, but you therefore, take the necessary precautions. You don't, you take care when pruning. You make sure you don't get the sap on your skin. You don't run away from everything that frightens you. You learn to control it and you learn, how to avoid the problems. And I think you're absolutely right with, poisonous plants. Pretty well everything in the garden is poisonous, is perhaps a little bit sort of over the top. But there are, as you say, many plants. But if they've got spines or prickles or toxic sap or whatever it is, you teach your children not to eat berries, or you plant the plant with berries at the back of the border where they can't get to it. You don't put a spiny plant right by a path where people are going to scratch themselves on the way through. You move it into the back of the border so it's not going to be in close proximity to little hands. Your euphorbia milii can go somewhere where, the child can't reach it, but they might reach it when they're 10 or 12, in which case they should know what spines are, and they should, they will have learned by then that spines hurt. So I think, you do have to make people aware, and they do have to know that plants like, rue can cause phytosensitivity and that euphorbia sap can be damaging. You have to make them aware of that. But once they're aware, then they should, react accordingly. And I think, there is a lot of, of overreaction to poisonous plants. It should never stop you. You think about all the good in growing plants, it should never stop you. And it's just a typical, these days we're extremely good at polarized opinions, extreme left, extreme right, extreme you shouldn't have this. The answer is we should be tolerant of all kinds of people, places, plants, attitudes, really.
I totally agree. Let me tell you a bit of a story, though, about a mistake I made. And I thought I was being so clever. So I had a cactus that, for reasons I now can't remember, died, and it was incredibly spiky. And I thought, aha, I have a cunning plan. I'm going to put this. I've got two big 2 by 2 meter raised beds at the back of my garden, which is mainly planted up with perennial vegetables. And I have problems with cats deciding to, but particular times of the year when there's more bare soil, coming to sort of do their business in there. So I thought, I'm going to have a clever idea here. I'm going to put this deceased cactus on this bed as a little spiny discouragement to the cats.
Remind me never to cross you.
I know, how mean. Anyway, so normally I put down sprigs of holly or branches and things, but I just thought, aha, this is going to work brilliantly. But I got... The cactus bit back in that it slowly decomposed, and I didn't really notice that, but slowly it decomposed and it got kind of half buried. And then when I was going to do some maintenance on this bed, I put my foot with my was wearing Crocs at the time, put my foot with my Crocs on it. Ooh. And then I ended up with many spines in the bottom of my Croc coming through into my bare foot. So that was my lesson about why dead cacti do not make good cat deterrents.
Well, all I can say is it serves you right.
It really does. It really does.
Yeah,
that was a lesson learned.
It is, you know, and I think, you know, and that, but that is, you know, in all being serious, being more serious now, that's about learning from experience, isn't it? And, you know, you mentioned your dead cacti. Well, you know, now your cacti don't die, but sometimes it's the only way you learn. But I think if you have got, you know, plants that you're sort of a little bit uncertain of, you know, and they sort of suit the style, like their growth habit is suitable, then hanging baskets are very useful because it sort of keeps everything well out of the way, you know, and then put a hanging basket in a corner of a room, so it's not within the area that you walk, then it's absolutely fine. So it's all this all the time thinking, right, this is the plant, where does it grow well? If it's got spines, that's absolutely fine. If it, you know, needs a massive amount of space to grow, you know, like a monstera, if you've got, you know, a calathea or something like that with, you know, big, attractive, variegated leaves, then that'll need a fair amount of space. So think about sort of the ultimate height and the best kind of location, bearing in mind safety, the growth needs of the plant, and the actual space that it's going to take up. So a bit of planning. But of course, you know what happens, Jane, because you've done this. You go to the garden centre and you go, oh, that looks nice, I'll have that. Oh, and that too. And you come home with a whole basket full of house plants, and then you go, right, where am I going to put them all? Oh, that's too big. That's not going to fit there. That the pot over, well, the habitat's right, but the pot overlaps the windowsill. So you do, if you can sort of control your urges to buy and be sort of measured about it, it does pay in the long run.
You're absolutely right. Although, had the number of people who've come up to me and said, it's all your fault that I've ended up with this houseplant obsession and I've got too many houseplants. So, yes, I hear you, but I suspect that many of us are unable to exercise that kind of self-control. But it's a very wise advice, because if you end up with too many houseplants in the wrong places, then it can all go horribly wrong. But hopefully when we're at Gardeners World Live, we can answer lots of people's queries and get people on the right track with their houseplants. So I'm really looking forward to seeing you in June, Matthew. And thanks so much for the chat today. I've learnt loads.
Well, thank you very much indeed for asking me. We're talking about houseplants, always enjoy it.
Thanks so much to Matt Biggs for joining me on the show this week. It's been a pleasure, and I hope you've enjoyed this little series of interludes from the potting shed, including the delightful pigeon incident. I will be putting full details of Matt's website and some of his books on my show notes at janeperrone.com, where you'll also find information about Gardeners World Live and other events that I'm appearing at this summer, including the Hampton Court Palace Flower Show. It's going to be an exciting summer, so I hope that I can meet you in person at some of those events. I'm going to try to get an On The Ledge t-shirt made up, so I should be very easy to spot. Now, I've got to go. I've got some Haworthias that desperately need potting up. More about those in a future episode. Oh, I'm giving you all the teasers this week, aren't I? But have a great planty week, and I shall see you next Friday for more houseplant fun. Bye!